How can all the cows we raise for meat help rather than hurt our environment? Documentary filmmaker Peter Bick is leading a team that's working on this very question.
We've been talking with McDonald's for a number of years about the idea that this type of grazing could give them a lot of benefits, could turn their main product, the hamburger, into a health food, could help their main product's production help mitigate climate change.
If the idea of getting up in front of a crowd to talk leaves you, well, speechless, we'll get tips from expert communicator G. Riley Mills.
Whatever it is you want, that's your objective. Your intention, then, is how you're going to get it. And it's always a one-word verb that you can activate through your communication. So I want to challenge. I want to excite. I want to motivate. I want to reprimand.
All that and more coming up on this Encore edition of The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope you're having a good New Year's Eve. And if you're driving, stay safe out there. Coming up this hour on this special Encore edition of The 21st, are you afraid of public speaking? Maybe you've even had a few communication snafus in front of a large crowd. Well, communication expert Gary Mills has got you covered. Plus, how a Muslim chaplain from Illinois wound up helping the producers of the Amazon series Jack Ryan. But first, we've all heard about how much cattle is a source of greenhouse gas emissions. Maybe you stopped eating beef or at least cut back because of its environmental impact. Well, that's also affected the bottom line of companies like McDonald's. So now McDonald's is investing in new research to find out better ways to raise cattle.
You know, these plants are just almost going nuts, so to speak, with photosynthetic activity once we take the cattle off. And that is allowing these plants, as they're rapidly regrowing, to capture carbon out of the air, you know, and put it back into the soil.
That's a clip from the short film Soil Carbon Cowboys. It features a few cattle farmers across the U.S. and Canada who have changed the way their cattle graze. And it showcases some of the initial findings of millions of dollars of research McDonald's has put into this issue. A team of 16 scientists and farmers from more than half a dozen universities, including the University of Illinois, are looking at understanding how changing the way cattle graze can not just cut carbon emissions, but reduce the use of pesticides. Earlier this year, we had a chance to speak with two of the men involved in this $4.7 million research project. Peter Bick teaches journalism at Arizona State University. He's a documentary filmmaker and a director who's leading the team. Jonathan Lundgren works at the Ecdysis Foundation. He got his PhD from the U of I. He's also working on this project. Hi, gentlemen. Welcome to The 21st.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Peter, when I first met you and you started telling me about this project, you said something to me that really stuck with me. You said it's not about the cattle, it's about the soil. What did you mean by that?
Well, the soil is the foundation for all life. And the way that grazing animals went across North America before the Europeans got here was the big herds of bison. The way those bison moved across the country created the best soils the earth has ever seen, especially here in Illinois. And that's what we're looking at. How do we replicate the way those bison moved across the Great Plains with the way we graze our cattle? Right now, the conventional way of grazing cattle is pretty much the opposite of that. We don't let them herd. We keep them on the same big area for a long period of time. But if you bunch all those cattle up into a herd and you move them in small paddocks frequently across your land, you can replicate the way the Great Plains were built.
Peter, can you remind us what cattle grazing has to do with carbon emissions and what the connection is with traditional cattle grazing?
Sure. Basically, it comes down to the soil. On the most part, the way our soils are being treated across the U.S. and across the world, the soils are actually expiring carbon. They're letting carbon go. But healthy soils draw down carbon through the plants, through photosynthesis. So whenever you see a field that doesn't have any plants growing on it, you're seeing something very, very dangerous. And it's not the way nature wants to be. Nature wants lots of different types of plants growing on that land. And lots of different types of plants bringing down CO2 feed lots of different types of microbes in the soil. When you have that biodiversity above and below ground, you have a system that's robust. It's actually drawing down carbon from the atmosphere. And to Jonathan's work, you get a lot of different plants and a lot of soil microbes. You get a whole lot of different bugs. And when you get a whole lot of different bugs, you get resilience.
So let's hear a little bit from two of the farmers and Soil Carbon Cowboys about how they've changed their fields.
Okay, these are sow thistles. They're a weed. But if you eat them when they're just flowering or in the bud, early bud stage, They're higher protein than what the alfalfa is.
My philosophy now is this. If livestock eat it, and it provides nutrition to those livestock, it's not a weed, it's a forage. And we're saving money. You know, we're not having to buy a herbicide, we're not having to employ machinery, you know, tractors and equipment to put it out as well.
That's a clip from Soil Carbon Cowboys. The short doc is going to be screened tomorrow at McDonald's headquarters right here in Illinois. We're talking to two of the guys behind the doc and this $4.7 million research project. By the way, you can also watch this. If you just go to soilcarboncowboys.com, you can watch this film that's 12 minutes. Jonathan Lundgren is with us as we're talking to him about his work in this. So, Jonathan, we just heard the farmers talk about how they're not using pesticides anymore. How does that make a difference when we're thinking about how that changes bugs in the soil and the environment?
Well, we often think about biodiversity just from a very pest-centric point of view, right? What is the disease? What is the insect pest? What is the weed that we're trying to kill? But when we have that mentality, we forget biodiversity is just the number of species that are out there. And for every one pest insect, I mean, entomologists estimate that there's, you know, 1,700 species on this planet. For every one species of pest, these 1,700 other species are doing things. We can't live without them. And so our decisions end up affecting this really greater community that society relies on, whether we know it or not.
When you look at grasslands, they support pollinating insects. And all those pollinating insects, when they're not pollinating the crops that we've just planted or that are flowering, they need to go someplace healthy to live. So the grasslands in the Midwest U.S. and the Great Plains and all that area, we're losing more acreage of grasslands in this part of the country than we're losing acres of Amazon forest. And so when we think of grasslands and grazing animals, they're part of an ecosystem that's much, much greater than just beef production. If you want to have healthy vegetables being produced, you need healthy soil, and you need those animals to get that soil healthy. So even if you're vegan, which a lot of my friends are, you still need the animal impact to get your soils healthy to produce the vegetables and the fruits that you want, and you need those grasslands to be the home to this huge, huge amount of insects that Jonathan works on. And when we kill one insect, we don't just kill one. Those pesticides don't have a spectrum of one. They kill them all. And so the idea of creating an area where all those insects get to live because we have all these different plants growing, that's the idea. And it comes down to nature. It comes down to letting nature have a seat at the table.
Fostering life in our farmland, you know. And that's what one of the ranchers involved in the project, his catchphrase is he's getting up in the morning, and he doesn't think about what he has to kill in the morning. He thinks about what he gets to grow and the life that he gets to promote on his farm. And changing that mentality, man, is so empowering. It is so empowering for these folks. And from the scientific perspective, too. The potential here, everybody wins in this situation. The ranchers are totally leading the science on this issue. And so the scientists on this team are learning just as quick as we can what these ranchers are able to understand just through their intuition and observation of their operations.
Before we get to more about what you're learning, Peter, how did you find these ranchers? How did you find ranchers, and how did you get them involved in this project, folks who were willing to change the way they were doing things?
Well, Bill Curtis narrated my film Carbon Nation. Bill Curtis had
another great Illinois connection there.
Yep.
Yeah.
And he had a beef company, and Alan Williams was his consultant. So Alan is the guy that we're hearing mostly from on these clips. So Alan Williams is one of the innovators of both AMP grazing, adaptive multi-paddock grazing, and in teaching people about it. So when I met Alan, I then started meeting a lot of scientists, including Jonathan. And this team of scientists got together because they were all really interested in this type of grazing. And they had their specialties. John's measuring and studying the bugs above and below ground. We have other folks studying the soil carbon content or the forage production. And so all these pieces of the puzzle came together, and that's how the team formed. And then it was through Alan and our network of where we started finding the farmers. And on this research that we're doing, it's in the southeast U.S., it's the adaptive multi-paddock farmers. They had to have a good relationship with their neighbor because we're studying across the fence line. We want to study both types of systems. So probably about 2% of American ranchers and farmers do this type of multi-paddock grazing, regenerative grazing. The other 98-99% of folks are doing the continuous grazing. And so we're measuring all of that right across the fence line. And so the project has been years in the making, And McDonald's came on board with a $4.5 million match just about 2 years ago. It took us about a year to find the money to match that. And we've been out in the field. I think Jonathan's team was out in early May, and we've been working all summer.
How did you get McDonald's to fund this?
We asked. And we had been talking with McDonald's for a number of years about the idea that this type of grazing could give them a lot of benefits, could turn their main product, the hamburger, into a health food, could help their main product's production help mitigate climate change, because if you're bringing down a lot of carbon, you're regenerating a lot of soils. It's a very positive thing. They've been going through their research internally, and then they were ready to pull the trigger about when we were ready with our proposal. So it's good timing and good aligned goals. McDonald's sounds just as happy about this as we are, which is really cool. I'm in McDonald's right now, and I just had a meeting that blew my mind. It's how do we go faster? How do we get more farmers to be doing this? Because that IPCC report that just came out, there was one paragraph in 180 pages about soil and carbon. And so there's so little science on this stuff. And Jonathan, being one of our key scientists and pushing this science, we need to measure what these farmers are doing, because what they're doing looks to be phenomenal. And we need to have that data so we can start changing the minds of the people who make up the IPCC and who run NGOs, because a lot of people just think we should eat less meat or no meat. And personally, I don't see how we regenerate our severely degraded soils without animal impact, without these herding animals. I don't know how we get to a healthier ag system, period.
Jonathan, to the bug side of this, because that's what you're doing. So when we heard that little clip of the guys planting all of these things that we used to think of as weeds, how does that change an ecosystem when they're just allowing things that were there naturally? He was talking about sour thistles, all these other things. I think sunflowers, right, that the cattle are eating. How does that change an ecosystem?
It changes the biodiversity. It changes the critters that live there. And that biodiversity is great, not just because we like species, but because biodiversity does things. It provides services that we need, right? And when you eliminate that biodiversity, what ends up happening is that you have to replace it. You have to replace it usually with an agrochemical of some sort. And that works for a while. But right now, a lot of our rangelands and a lot of our farmland in general is kind of hitting a wall with what we can produce. Like Peter said, we can't be raising our food. The livestock in that system is so important in terms of keeping that ecosystem moving. It's a valuable tool. We're trying to learn as quickly as we can to make these systems that the farmers are adopting into something that can be transferred and scaled across the country.
This is the initial stages of the research, Jonathan. What are you hoping specifically to learn or to show?
What's so unique about this project is the fact that there are 16 different disciplines that are on board. We're going to be able to do transformative science where we're linking different disciplines that have never been applied to the same system before. We're going to be able to link biodiversity, be it microbes, be it insect function, all the way to rancher well-being, to carbon sequestration, to landscape level effects. That's really exciting stuff, really innovative, really important in exacting change to our food system.
Peter, when we think about that, all of these people that you've convened, you're a documentary filmmaker, but as I said at the beginning, you teach documentary filmmaking, you teach in the sustainability school at ASU as well as in journalism. As Jonathan's describing the scope of this, how did you end up involved with all of this, being the team leader of this?
When we made Carbon Nation, that's a film about solutions to climate change. And the solution that kept coming up in our research and in our filming was the soils. And in the soil specifically, the grazing of the soils. And so as I'm looking for ways that we can draw down more carbon than we're emitting, it became a clear path for me to look at that. So when we made Soil Carbon Cowboys, the short film that you've been playing clips of in 2013, I started the research and I started finding the scientists who are working on the pieces of this puzzle. Like, we've got the folks looking at the greenhouse gases. You know, what's happening with the methane? Do you have methanotrophic bacteria that love to eat methane? And so the methane question about the animals is a big one, but how much methane are they emitting when the whole system is also sucking up methane? What's that balance? Are the animals doing well? Is the plant forage productive? And all these pieces of the puzzle came together, and it was just a vacuum of need. And I'd just been hired by ASU, which is an incredibly innovative university, and they let this filmmaker start this science project. And I started bringing in funding. and really good scientists, and it just sort of happened. It's the same skill set as making a movie, and I have a great passion for this solution. Our soils are in really, really bad shape. I'm more worried about our soils than I am about climate change, and I'm really worried about climate change. But these farmers are healing their soils so quickly, and these ranchers, that I want to give them the biggest platform. I want to give our science team the best way to measure these things so we can communicate this information, because I think this is a huge opportunity to do so many good things.
That's Peter Bick. He is a documentary filmmaker. He's the director producer of Soil Carbon Cowboys, which is the short film that we've been talking about here. I want to thank Jonathan Lundgren for being with us as well with the Ichthysis Foundation. Jonathan, Peter, thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks for tuning into this encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Here's a speech you don't want to give.
Ladies and gentlemen of the Starr County Republican Party Executive Committee, good evening. My name is Phil Davison, and I am seeking our party's nomination for the position of Starr County Treasurer on November of 2010.
That example of communication gone awry led to this unfortunate local official's viral web video a few years ago. And it's used by my next guest when he's teaching people how to better communicate. Gary Mills is the co-founder of Pinnacle Performance Company. It's a global communications firm that's based in Chicago. And his most recent book is called The Bullseye Principle: Mastering Intention-Based Communication to Collaborate, Execute, and Succeed. I sat down with him earlier this year from our studios at Northwestern University in Evanston, and I started by asking him why he uses that video as an example.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite videos online right now. Phil Davison was a local politician in Ohio and gave a speech in 2010 while he was running for office that went viral. Millions and millions of hits on YouTube. He became famous for being the worst speaker of all time. So if you Google right now, worst speaker of all time or worst speech of all time, you will get the number one out of 18 million results. The number one very first video is going to be Phil Davison. So it's quite a distinction. And in 2010, our first book came out called The Pin Drop Principle. And we used to play that video when we would do keynotes, when we would do speeches, when we'd go on our book tour, my co-founder and co-author David Lewis and I. And one day we got off stage and I said to Dave, I said, I wonder what happened to that guy after he gave that speech that made him famous. And also, if we would have gotten a hold of him before he gave that speech and coached him, could we have made him a better speaker? And Dave said, good questions, let's find out. So I tried to track this guy down, and there was nothing on Facebook, nothing on Google. I could not find Phil Davison.
Which is a smart response to anyone who's had 15 minutes of that kind of fame. Right?
Right. And so one day I'm on LinkedIn, and I punch in the name Phil Davison, and I found him. And I sent him a message and I said, hey, I have this global communication skills training company. We're huge fans of your video. We play it all around the world in our sessions. Would you be willing for us to fly you to Chicago and spend 2 hours with us? We want to teach you our methodology on how to be a more effective communicator and see if we can make you better. And to our shock, he said, yeah, I'm in. Let's try it. So we flew him to Chicago. I picked him up at O'Hare International Airport, took him down to our office and spent 2 hours with him, you know, teaching him our three-step process, teaching him about intention, how to have a goal with your communication, what you want your audience to feel, what you want them to do. And at the end of the 2 hours, he understood why his speech had gone off the rails. And I said, do you by chance still remember the words to that famous speech from a couple of years back? And he said, I do. I said, let's redo it now, knowing what you know about these three steps and about how to present your information to an audience to make them feel a certain way. And he redid it and we filmed it and it was amazing. He was completely different, relaxed, personable, passionate, confident, and it just made a world of difference. So he now travels with me when I do big keynotes, and I plant him in the audience. He's there and I'll pull him up at the end after we show his two videos, and it's always a huge hit.
So that other video is on your website, and we will tweet that link out as well for people yes, to see the other one.
Absolutely. You got to see what we call the redemption video of Phil Davison. So I'm happy to give you that link.
Gary, you have a really unique background, both in the business world and in acting. And I wanted to ask how your acting informs the way that you teach communication.
Great question. Yeah, my background was as a professional actor. I trained at DePaul's Theater School back in the late 80s, or early 90s. And so my background, I've done TV, I've done film, I've done theater, commercials, and it's really that skill set that started Pinnacle. We've been around about 13 years. And the way we approach communication is we bring the toolbox of techniques and skills and tricks that actors use, how to use your voice, how to use your body language, how to prepare, how to have an intention, how to identify an objective with your communication you want to accomplish, and we bring that skill set into the corporate environment. And so we teach people in a very quick way how to use your voice, how to make people feel a certain way, how to prepare, how to use pacing, how to use facial expressions, how to use gestures. Yeah, because it all applies.
And I think that's what you talk about in this book. And I think communication is one of those things we all have to do no matter what kind of work we do. How often do you think we're getting it wrong?
We're getting it wrong a lot because people, number one, don't know how to prepare for a communication, whether it's running a meeting, whether it's delivering a presentation, whether it's giving a performance review, whether it's talking to your kid about whatever it is you want them to accomplish at school or with a sport. We don't have an objective. We don't know how to prepare. We don't have an objective that we're going after. And a lot of times our communication is incongruent. That's one of the biggest problems, is there's not congruence with communication, meaning all the different intention cues are not lined up. They're not telling the same story. So if they're not telling the same story, if there's not congruence with your message, the person or the audience you're trying to influence are not going to know how to feel about the information. And that's a problem because you're not going to get what you want.
And how do you think, how much has the business world changed the way that it communicates?
A lot of changes happening in the business world right now. Technology for sure is just, there's a huge impact on what's happening technology-wise. People don't want to sit through 100 slides anymore. 10 years ago, that was probably okay to sit through 100 slides during a presentation with walls of words. People don't have time for that anymore, and they don't have patience for it. They want, tell me a story. Give me an image, tell me a story, and let's move it along. So I think technology is definitely changing the way we communicate. A lot of far-flung teams where I've got people in India, I've got people in London, I've got people in Paris, and we're using technology to try to stay in contact, try to stay into communication, which is a challenge as well.
And what about communication the way everyone else communicates? And I'm thinking about our country, America 2018. Donald Trump's a clearly very effective communication style that led to his election as a president, but there's so much communication and conversation about our public discourse and how we're not communicating these days.
It's a great point. It really is. Weird things have happened since 2016, right? On the way we see leadership, on the way we see effective communication, because you're absolutely right. Whether you love him or hate him, Trump is good at messaging. He's great at branding. He's great at analyzing his audience. And this is something I write about in Bullseye Principle. is, politics aside, how did he get elected? He got elected. And a lot of that came from the way he communicated his message, the way he influenced the emotions of that sliver of the audience that put him over the top, that came out to vote for him. They liked his strut. They liked his swagger. They liked his improvisational style of speaking. They liked that he busted some norms that we've all come to accept as, this is how you behave if you're a leader. Those people that put him over the top, he generated an emotion in them that got them to the polls. And so that's undeniable. We have to address that. So whoever's running next against him, you better not forget about that, because you're going to have to adjust your communication style to play in his ball game.
My guest is Gary Mills. He's the co-author of a new book just out about business communication that we're talking about. It's called The Bullseye Principle, Mastering Intention-Based Communication to Collaborate, Execute, and Succeed. Gary, what do you mean by intention-based communication?
So as an actor, one of the first things you learn in your training is you have to have an objective in a scene, meaning something you want from your scene partner, right? I want him to leave me alone. I want her to give me the magic ring. I want control over this kingdom. Whatever it is you want, that's your objective. Your intention then is how you're going to get it. And it's always a one-word verb that you can activate through your communication. So I want to challenge. I want to excite. I want to motivate. I want to reprimand. I want to persuade. Those are all great intentions, because you can activate those with your body language, with your voice, and with every aspect of your communication. So that's the basis of what actors learn, but it translates seamlessly into the corporate environment. If you're running a meeting, delivering a presentation, or giving a performance review, which pretty much everybody in the corporate environment has to do at least one of those three things, if not all three, you have to start by analyzing your audience. Who are they? What do they want? How much do they know? How much do they not know? Second step, you got to understand then how you want them to feel and what you want them to do as a result of hearing your message. And then the third step is you're going to modify your delivery, meaning I'm going to change my body language, my voice, my gestures, my pacing, my word choices based on those first two questions. So analyze your audience, understand how you want them to feel, and then modify your delivery. Those are the three steps that are really important to deliver an effective message.
And what do you think nonverbal cues, like looking at people's body language and your body language, are so important?
I always tell people, if you ever want to know how your message is being received during your presentation or your meeting or that performance review, you have an instant scorecard. At any point, look at the faces in your audience. How are they taking in that information? What is their reaction? If they close up, cross their arms, slink back in their chair, roll their eyes, they are giving you information about how they feel about what you are saying. And you have to then adjust your tactics accordingly to make them feel the way you want them to feel.
And I also wonder, when we're thinking about, at the same time you're saying that, the radio person in me loved your research about how it's much easier for us to understand someone's intention when we just hear their voice,
yeah,
rather than actually seeing them. I could have told you that non-scientifically, but
right.
Why do you think our voice is so important?
That was an amazing study that's included in the book that I was very, very surprised when I came across that. It basically said that when they break down communication, if you just see someone, if you see and hear someone, or if you just hear someone, the just hearing someone, there's more clear information coming from that. I don't know. I think because there's so much with the vocal dynamics of our voice, and when there's intention behind our voice, it's just so powerful and so clear, because you're using all aspects of your voice: tone, pitch, articulation, pace, volume, and every single element of that creates a really clear package if they're all aligned.
I think we can also hear emotion in people's voices, so I think we trust that. I think there's something instinctual about that, so we can tell if people are nervous, if they're sad. I think that's also part of it too.
Absolutely.
But how does this work if you don't have, and I'm thinking what you said in the beginning about technology and about how many of us work remotely. what communication is like when you, I think very little of our communication in a, particularly in a work environment sometimes is face-to-face, or you don't even hear people's voices. It's done via an email, or I'm thinking our office, we use Slack or other messaging services. How often do you think that gets misread?
It's true. I think the study in Bullseye that we talk about says around 50% of the time we misinterpret the tone of an email. So that's not a great statistic. And that's something we all need to be aware of, which means if you're ever delivering emotional or very important information to another person to get that message across, don't do it if at all possible through email, because it's going to get misinterpreted. It could be one word that sets somebody off. They interpret it a different way. And it might not even be the tone that you meant, but they interpret it that way, and it goes haywire. When you're communicating through conference calls, which a lot of people do because we have teams all over the world, there's no visual. So the gestures, the facial expressions, the eye contact, the smile, everything's gone. So two things become really important when you're communicating through conference calls or when there's no visual. The first is vocal dynamics and what we just talked about, how you use all aspects of the voice, how you use pacing, how you use your volume, how you use your articulation, your pitch, your tone, all those things, very important. Second thing, when there's no visuals, active listening, right? Being actively listening and knowing that, wow, Robin hasn't said anything for the last 5 minutes in this meeting. I better go out to Robin and make sure she's with us, make sure she doesn't disagree, make sure she's not having different ideas about the topic we're talking about. So active listening and vocal dynamics become king when you are communicating and there's no visuals.
And here's the tough part for people when you are communicating, and for people whom public speaking, I know you don't like that word, but I think it gets at what we're talking about here. When you are speaking in front of a group, there are some people for whom that's very tough. Even speaking up during a meeting is something that's difficult for them. It causes anxiety. They're nervous. What's your advice to help boost confidence in that kind of situation? Is it about boosting confidence, actually? I'm also sort of assuming something in that question.
Right. Yes, it's goes to confidence. But also, what's the number one reason why people are nervous before they give a presentation, deliver a speech, run a meeting? The number one reason, not prepared. And what we teach in our methodology at Pinnacle is we say, if you're not prepared for that presentation, you should be nervous. Shame on you. And we have one whole chapter in the book that shows you how to prepare properly. So if you can go into that meeting completely prepared, it's going to take a lot of those nerves away.
What about picturing people naked?
I don't like that.
You know.
I don't prefer that. I don't prefer that.
Gary, as we're thinking about the way that we communicate, your work obviously is in a corporate setting, but as we're thinking about just going back to our conversation at the beginning about our political discourse and the way that we are communicating just on a daily basis, what's your advice for everyone listening?
My advice is, whenever possible, seek mutuality, right? We all, in the end, want the same thing. So let's work together. Let's collaborate. Let's try to be on the same page. Let's listen to each other. I think there's no mutuality. Nobody's trying to find common ground. People aren't listening to each other. They go to their separate camps, and my way is the only way, and I'm not listening to anything else. So nothing penetrates. Nothing gets through to people in this current environment. And I think we're never going to move forward from a communication standpoint and be able to collaborate and cooperate until we seek mutuality and get on the same page.
Gary Mills is the co-founder of Chicago-based Pinnacle Performance Company. He's also the co-author of The Bullseye Principle, Mastering Intention-Based Communication to Collaborate, Execute, and Succeed. Gary, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
Dr. Ryan, I need you to come with me.
What?
We have to go.
Maybe I'm foolish, maybe I'm blind.
What have you got?
The individual behind these transactions could be a high-level target. His name is Suleiman.
How come you're the only one that knows about this mystery man?
I was just following the money, sir.
They have cells in France, Yemen, Syria, and those are just the ones we know about. There's something different about his agenda.
I'd like to set up a task force.
Whatever he's planning, he's ready now.
I can't go to Yemen. I'm an analyst. I don't interrogate people. I write reports.
Get on the plane.
That's a trailer for the Amazon Prime Video series Jack Ryan. Have you seen it? It's the most recent adaptation of the Tom Clancy character. It's true to the original novels in its intensity and blockbuster action sequences. But in this modern adaptation, all the characters, including James Greer, Jack Ryan's soon-to-be wife Kathy, and the new character, the terrorist Suleiman, are different than what we normally see on TV. Loyola University Chicago professor and chaplain Omar Muzaffar consulted on the series. He's also a longtime contributor to RogerEbert.com, and I spoke to him when the series first came out to talk about how Muslims are depicted in this Amazon series. Chaplain Muzaffar, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me. Honored to be on the show.
What went through your head when you saw an email from Paramount asking you to consult with them on this project?
Well, when I first received contact from them, I thought it was a joke, and I ignored it. But then I decided, because it had a Paramount.com address, I had to take it seriously. And so I responded, and then they informed me that they're looking to get advice and consultancy on this upcoming TV show.
Roger Ebert named you a far-flung correspondent a while ago. What kinds of things have you written for RogerEbert.com over the years?
So Roger was a mentor of mine. I had taken classes with him a couple of decades ago. We reconnected on his blog, and he discovered there's many film critics from across the world. So he pulled me in to write for him along with others, although I was the only one who was truly local. And he gave us freedom to write whatever we want, whenever we wanted. So I wrote essays about all kinds of movies. And I would position myself as a viewer, as who I am, which is essentially a Muslim raised in Chicago. And so pretty much everything from Avatar to George Clooney movies, and then definitely movies that featured Muslims in the cast or behind the scenes.
And so I wonder, was this maybe, I don't know if this is, and you wrote about this for RogerEbert.com, about how this was a bit of an ethical dilemma for you when they asked you to consult on this, because ultimately at the end of the day, the main character in this who's Muslim is a terrorist.
Yeah. It's from start to finish, it was going to be a terrorist villain, a Muslim terrorist villain. And so I had to decide whether or not I wanted to be in support of such a show. There's a lot of shows right now, like, for example, Homeland, a lot of movies that have Muslim terrorists, and they're almost always presented as just these vile, theologically driven monsters. But going through a lot of deliberation, as well as looking through old Islamic as well as classical Western sources and reflections on ethics, I decided that it's better that I do it, because if not me, they're going to find someone else who may be less qualified. And so I went for it.
And as I watched this, I thought it was interesting. I've watched Homeland. I've watched, I think, probably every season of Homeland. As I was watching this, new Jack Ryan series, it is different. I was really struck by one of the characters, Suleiman's wife. She is presented, and we first meet her, and her head is covered. But then when we see her with her family in her family setting, she is not wearing a head covering. That surprised me. It seemed a little unusual. We learn a lot about the character Suleiman and why he is. And then I was also very surprised that James Greer, who is a famous Tom Clancy character in this adaptation, he's also Muslim.
Mm-hmm. The exploration in terms of how to present Muslims, I mean, the central concern was to be sensitive and to still add to and contribute to the drama of the show. My goal was to show the humanity of the characters. I have quite a bit of experience in counter-radicalization work, so I have a lot of familiarity with the characters who might be depicted. And almost no one's ever driven by theology. Usually there's some very, very serious problem. And we saw in the characters of Suleiman and his brother, they suffered from an attack on their house, and then they go through their own transformation later on in life. And I think that's more authentic, but I think it also just adds a lot more drama.
Right. And that is an interesting, there's a lot of backstory to this that I do not want to give away as spoilers for people who haven't seen it. And I do think it's very interesting that the two main characters, these two brothers who are the main terrorists, are presented as they were born in Lebanon, their parents are killed, and then they are raised in France. And there is this whole interesting side plot about France and Muslims in France. And I wanted to just play a little clip, actually, of the executive producers talking about what they wanted to do with these characters in scene commentary.
We didn't want to have archetypal Muslim extremist bad guys. We wanted to show that these were people who were molded by the circumstances of their life.
We wanted the audience to really understand Suleiman's alienation from French society.
Suleiman wasn't always going to be the person that he becomes when we meet him in the pilot. We wanted to draw a parallel between Jack Ryan and Suleiman. And so that's why we created this backstory of him having aspirations to be in finance. Because as anyone who is familiar with the novels knows, Jack Ryan came from the finance world. And so we always thought about Suleiman as he could have been Jack Ryan if it weren't for a couple of twists and turns in the road. And yes, he made a conscious decision to go another way, but we definitely wanted to draw the parallel between the hero and the villain and show that it isn't such a drastic line between the two individuals.
That's executive producers Graham Rowland and Carlton Cuse of the new Amazon series Jack Ryan speaking in scene commentary. We're talking to Loyola University Chicago professor and chaplain Omar Muzaffar, who consulted on the series. Chaplain, so what was your role? What kind of things did they ask you about? As we were thinking about, that's the thinking of the producers. I wonder what role you played in conversations with them and helping them shape this, if that was their motivation.
So in a nutshell, I came in to fill in the blanks. So they had the idea set, and now the question was, how do we articulate it? And so some of the questions would just relate to, all right, how do people in Lebanon, when they're at home and dads are playing or family members are playing a board game, what would they be playing, especially in 1980 or 1990? It would be some particular cultural questions like that, or what type of background backstory would work for such a character like Suleiman. I mean, what they described in that clip, what the executive producer described, I think is consistent with their careers. They also wrote for Lost, the TV show, and so much of Lost was based on, was driven by the backstories of the characters. And so I was the guy who said, well, they could be like this, or they could be like this, or they could be like this. I personally think this would be the most dramatic. And sometimes they'd listen, sometimes they had better ideas, and that was how the collaboration took place.
Chaplain, as we're thinking about this, I wonder how unusual you think that approach is when you look at what we see on the screen, whether it's television screens or movie screens, what you think the dominant narrative is when we see Muslims these days.
Well, I think that's a pretty simple question to answer. The vast majority of depiction of Muslims is as terrorists. When most people who think Muslims, especially if they don't know any Muslims personally, they'll think something negative, violent, savage. Before terrorists, it was something like wife beater from what we saw with that Sally Field movie, Not Without My Daughter. And that's, of course, completely disconnected from the reality of most Muslims, including myself. The vast majority of my Muslim friends told me straight up that they had no intention of watching the show because they thought it was just another Muslim terrorist show. And then when they found out that I worked on it, they all decided to give it a chance. And most of them spoke favorably of the depiction of Muslims, but they still didn't like the fact that at the end of the day, they were Muslim terrorists.
Why do you think it is that what people see on a screen has so much impact on what they think about culture? Is it because they don't have other day-to-day or personal experience with people?
I think part of it is the lack of day-to-day personal experience with people. I grew up in a town that was very, very Christian. It's South Holland, Illinois. It's literally called a community of churches. And so the Christians around me informed me about what Christianity is just by their good character and conduct. if someone doesn't know any Muslims, then they're going to be limited to television, and that's going to be their default. Or if you're a Muslim growing up watching these images, you will internalize negative aspects. It doesn't mean you're going to become a terrorist, but you are going to internalize the sense that you have to, you know, prove that you are not a terrorist, almost as though it's something apologetic. The African-American scholar W.E.B. Du Bois has this idea of double consciousness, where you're concerned about the things you're concerned about, but then on top of that, you're concerned about what everybody else has to think about you. And so representation in media becomes very important. An example of that would be the movie Crazy Rich Asians, which shows Chinese, in particular East Asians in general, from all types of different backgrounds and personalities. But if you're somebody young in East Asian, seeing those characters on the screen, you're seeing something you may have never seen in your life.
People who look like usually. You. What about you? When you were growing up, you mentioned in South Holland, what images of Muslims were predominant in American culture?
So growing up in Chicago and South Holland in the 1970s, the most famous boxer in the world was Muhammad Ali. The most famous basketball player, one of the most famous basketball players, was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. The Sears Tower, now the Willis Tower, was designed by a Muslim. And so that was my norm, that the best of the best were Muslims. And my parents would add that that was my obligation, that you had to be the best of the best because that's what Muslims are supposed to do. So I never was taught that there's a conflict between being Muslim and American. That conversation was never anywhere in my world. And my job was just to grow and work as hard as I can and be the best that I can as is required by the tradition that I'm being raised with.
I wonder what you say now to this generation as someone, you teach theology in Chicago at Loyola, when you're also the chaplain. So I imagine you're interacting as a Muslim chaplain with lots of students. What message do you try to impart to them? I wonder, as you're thinking, particularly in light of this Jack Ryan series.
Well, I mean, it's the same message to the Muslims and to the non-Muslims, that you have an obligation to be the best. And to the Muslims, for most of them, they don't have any major role models in mainstream media. There's the Olympian Ibtihaj Muhammad, who won a bronze medal as a fencer, and I liked her book, but ultimately she's not as big as Muhammad Ali was, right? And so it's as though this generation, without heroes, has to still work to strive to be the best.
Mm.
And again, that's consistent with the Loyola Jesuit outlook anyway, so it fits perfectly.
Right. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us between classes. Omar Muzaffar is the Muslim chaplain, and he's also a lecturer in theology and in modern languages and literature at Loyola University Chicago. He's also a correspondent, as we mentioned, for RogerEbert.com. We will tweet out his most recent piece about the Jack Ryan series that he consulted on for Amazon Prime Video. Chaplain, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's all the time we have for today, actually for this year. We're off tomorrow for New Year's Day, but we'll continue our series of holiday encores on Wednesday. We'll revisit our conversation with two of the year's MacArthur Fellows from Illinois and Academy Award-nominated director Steve James on his 10-part documentary series set in Oak Park, Illinois, called America to Me.
Oak Park, this school is crazy. It's like a social experiment.
In this community, there are levels of diversity, but we mentioned race, all hell breaks loose.
Join us on Wednesday for that. If you have the NPR One app, you can download that for wherever you get your smartphone apps. It's a good way to find past shows. It's pretty simple to download. Then you can set your home station to get that news. And if you search for the 21st to follow us, it's an easy way to listen to past shows. We're also available wherever you get your podcasts. Our Twitter handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the hour with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. Our Facebook page, if you want to search for the 21st to like us, is another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Vishesh Anand, Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.